from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Another flare-up of fighting in Ukraine with more casualties after Western-backed troops shelled eastern cities, killing at least six. Press TV's Hassan Tavakoli has more.
Ukrainian officials say at least six people have been killed in fresh clashes in the east over the past 24 hours. Ukraine's military spokesman says one civilian died in an artillery attack on a chemical plant near Donetsk. A soldier and four pro-Russia forces were also killed in the latest clashes. The heaviest fighting took place near the strategic port city of Mariupol. The latest outbreak of violence comes despite a truce that pro-Russia militias and Ukraine's government signed in February. Since then, sporadic clashes have taken place, with both sides accusing each other of violations. More than 6,000 people have been killed since the war began in eastern Ukraine in April 2014. The United States has once again criticized Russia's stance on the crisis in Ukraine. U.S. President Barack Obama accused Moscow of aggression against Ukraine as he met NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg.
We had a chance to discuss the situation in Ukraine and the increasingly aggressive posture that Russia has taken, and we affirmed that NATO...
Obama and Stoltenberg both called for the warring sides in eastern Ukraine to respect the truce deal reached in February. Back then, some European powers, as well as Russia and Ukraine, agreed to put an end to the war in the volatile region. But both Ukrainian forces and pro-Russia fighters have sporadically violated the truce. In recent days, there has been particularly heavy fighting there. Nearly 6,300 people have been killed, and over 1 million have been made homeless by the conflict.
But political analyst Eric Dreitzer points out that it was not Russia that overthrew the elected government in Kiev, and it isn't Russia that is shelling Ukrainian cities.
While President Obama can certainly make the claim that it is Russia that's ratcheting up the tensions, in fact, the reality on the ground is quite the opposite. In fact, it's completely the opposite of what the United States narrative has been from the very beginning, because, of course, while they've tried to say that Russia is the aggressor in eastern Ukraine, it is the Kiev government that is backed by the United States, handpicked by the United States, and its military and paramilitary fascist auxiliaries that have really been escalating the conflict and have repeatedly broken the specifics of the Minsk ceasefire agreement. Of course, we have in the last 48 hours, we have multiple claims, multiple reports of shelling of the city of Donetsk. We have at least reports of at least nine people killed thus far. And it should be remembered, and Obama conveniently forgets this, that that is in fact a war crime. This is the indiscriminate shelling of civilian targets for the purposes of collective punishment. It has no military objective. This is clearly in violation of the Geneva Convention, of the UN Charter of International Law, of all norms of international relations. And this is all completely blacked out in the U.S. Corporate media. And Obama can sit there in Washington and make claims about Putin and make claims about Russia, but anybody who follows this situation, who understands the strategy, can see quite clearly that it is the United States and its puppet government in Ukraine that is fomenting this conflict and is looking to extend this war. And this is in the midst of a humanitarian catastrophe in Donetsk and in Lugansk and the Donbass generally, and a growing humanitarian catastrophe in greater Ukraine, where the economy is totally collapsing, where all of the aid that has been given to Kiev has gone into military spending for the purposes of doing exactly what Kiev is doing, escalating the war, dragging this out, killing more innocent people. And so it's not only is it farcical and completely insane that Obama would say this, I think that it is utterly disrespectful, utterly disgraceful to the families of those who have been killed in Donetsk, to the families of those who have been killed all over Donbass. And I think that ultimately what is coming down to is that Obama is playing on a defensive posture because he knows that he walked into a quagmire in Ukraine, that they kicked the hornet's nest, and now they don't know what to do. But for political reasons, they cannot admit it publicly. And that is the shame of U.S. politics.
Late Wednesday, another shelling by U.S.-backed forces killed three members of a family sleeping in their home in Gorlovsk. On the heels of revelations that some 16 million people in Yemen are without drinking water, the World Health Organization announced Wednesday that nearly 9 million Yemenis are in need of urgent medical care. As the Saudi bombing campaign against that country entered its third month, Dr. Margaret Chan from WHO said people are dying because hospitals lack fuel and basic medicines for such conditions as diabetes and hypertension. Dr. Chan said that the ongoing violations of international humanitarian law need to stop, including the airstrikes, which have been targeting health facilities, staff, and patients. Daniel Johnson has more.
Amid a recent upsurge in fighting in Yemen, Dr. Chan appealed for an end to what she called the unnecessary loss of innocent lives. The WHO Director General said that civilians continue to pay the highest price for the conflict between government-backed and Houthi forces. Some 2,000 people have died since late March and 8,000 have been injured by the fighting, including hundreds of women and children. In her statement, Dr. Chan said vastly insufficient medicines had been brought into Yemen during the five-day ceasefire earlier this month, enough for just 400,000 people. But around 8.6 million people need urgent medical care. The WHO chief added that hospitals around the country have had to close key operating units owing to fuel and staff shortages, while medicines for chronic conditions such as diabetes, hypertension and cancer are no longer available. Dr. Chan also warned against continuing attacks on medical facilities, including hospitals, ambulances and a blood transfusion center, which had left health workers dead. The WHO appeal follows the postponement of UN-brokered peace talks in Geneva. Daniel Johnson, United Nations.
This past Monday, demonstrators marked the passing of the 8-month anniversary of the forcible disappearance of 43 Ayotzinapa student teachers, with actions in several cities across Mexico. Family members of the 43 students led four simultaneous marches in Mexico City alone, tying up the city's center. The demonstrators demanded justice for the 43 and called on the government to speed up its investigation into the case. They also called for a boycott of upcoming June 7th midterm elections, hoping to tap into widespread disgust with the country's political system over pervasive corruption and a culture of impunity. Last month, Mexico's Transparency Agency ordered the declassification of government files on possible military participation in the Ayotzinapa event, but thus far the archives have not been made public. Telesur's Clayton Kahn filed this report from Mexico City.
Activists, classmates, and families of the 43 disappeared students gather in four different points in Mexico City to march and paralyze the Capitol Center. Over these past 8 months, the parents of the youth have found their voice while losing respect for that of the authorities.
I am truly disappointed with this government. I am not just some fool that they can control. I now understand that I can think for myself, and so I will not vote for any party.
While the families are calling for a boycott of upcoming June 7th midterm elections, supporting activists say the case of Ayotzinapa is just one of many abuses perpetrated by the country's security forces, fomenting widespread distrust of the political class.
This is a reflection of all the bad things that happened. Sadly, the Mexican state is colluding with organized crime, and it is full of violence and corruption. And we, the citizens, are on the receiving end of all of this.
As the marches advanced in the capital, they arrived to the site of an improvised so-called anti-monument erected 1 month ago to ensure that as each month continues to go by, the struggle for justice for the 43 youth is not forgotten.
This anti-monument is one more scar on the country. It is a scarring memory in a country where human rights, student rights, farm worker rights, and the rights of all the underprivileged are violated.
This past month, the country's Transparency Institute ordered the declassification of documents of the military's presumed participation, a demand of the families. However, the authorities have yet to comply. Although 8 months have passed, the parents behind me say they are not tired, and they will not go home unless they have truth and justice, rather than the lies that they say the government is providing. Clayton Cantalasur, Mexico City.
China issued its 2015 White Paper on National Defense Tuesday, which calls for a strategy of active defense to effectively deter threats and better protect the country's national interests. The document also lays out the developing trend of its military capabilities. CCTV's Sean Calabs laid out some of the aspects of the White Paper.
The paper is entitled China's Military Strategy, and it details how Chinese armed forces will contribute to President Xi Jinping's plan to rejuvenate the nation and what he calls the Chinese Dream. It calls for military plans to immediately focus on four key areas, and here they are: outer space, cyberspace, nuclear force, and the ocean. The military buildup in the South China Sea and the East China Sea is getting most of the attention right now. The paper also focuses on what Chinese officials label active defense, which it calls the essence of the Communist Party's military strategic thought. The white paper does make a point of noting that Chinese armed forces are committed to protecting what it calls the country's territorial sovereignty, integrity, and security. It also discusses U.S. President Obama's Asian pivot, that is, the United States' effort to refocus its attention away from long-time trouble spots such as Iraq and Afghanistan, and then focus on the Pacific. The paper says that Japan is also bolstering its military in the region, alleging Tokyo, and we quote here, is sparing no effort to dodge the post-war mechanism. The document also accused what it calls offshore neighbors of provocative actions. And it is, of course, a reference to Vietnam and the Philippines and the ongoing dispute over territorial rights to the islands in the South China Sea. Now, the United States military has weighed in on this new blueprint that China released. The Pentagon saying the U.S. has, and again we quote, repeatedly called on the Chinese for transparency. And frankly, they say, this is transparency, saying this is a step in the right direction.
But Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was quick to seize on the new strategic framework outlined in the white paper to help him sell his continuing attempts to expand the set of circumstances under which Japan can use its military to Japan's parliament.
I won't name a particular country again and again, but there is a country in the Asia-Pacific region building up its military power. Take what's happening in the South China Sea or in the East China Sea. It is important to preserve peace and stability by maintaining the military balance and deterrence. We should not show any seam in our defense.
For its part, China was quick to respond to the criticism from Abe. This was Hua Chunying from China's foreign ministry at a press conference Wednesday.
China suffered a long time from foreign aggression and humiliation after entering the modern age. We value peace, oppose wars, adhere to the path of peaceful development, and pursue a national defense policy with a defensive nature. Meanwhile, historical lessons teach us that we must build a national defense power that is matched with national security needs and economic development level. We will never allow any country to violate China's sovereignty and territorial integrity.
Earlier this week, China lodged a complaint with Washington over yet another incident involving a U.S. surveillance plane which flew over disputed territory in the South China Sea. And as we've previously reported, former top CIA official Michael Morell said last week that he believed a U.S. war with China was a real possibility. And another prominent voice, billionaire George Soros, also raised that concern in an article published last Friday by the Russian news agency Sputnik, where he was quoted as saying that there is a real danger that China will align itself with Russia politically and militarily, making a threat of a third world war become real. He suggested that the U.S. bind China to the Western-dominated global system by allowing its currency to join the International Monetary Fund's monetary system. With more on that, we spoke with Richard Wolff, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst and visiting professor in the graduate program in international affairs at the New School University in New York.
First, in the larger historical sense that Soros often relates to, which makes his commentary have a greater depth than most of the others that one hears. He's trying to tell us, or remind us perhaps, that economic warfare has a nasty habit of degenerating into military warfare. It has happened so often, particularly in the last 200 or 300 years, when capitalism has been the dominant economic system, that to not worry about it is what would have to be defended. In other words, he's pointing out what should be the common anxiety across the world, rather than the absurd complacency about these issues that informs most other comments. Second point, where does that complacency come from beside historical amnesia? The answer is the symbiotic or codependent relationship between China and the United States, or indeed between China on the one hand and what we would have to call the old centers of capitalism, Western Europe, North America, and Japan. And the basic relationship there is as follows. Capitalists in those old centers, U.S., European, Japanese, have been making a fortune of money in their interactions with China. Let me briefly explain. On the one hand, they have been able to keep down the wages they pay their workers because those workers can take fairly stagnant wages and keep buying more stuff thanks to China and its ability to deliver consumer goods at declining prices. In other words, you might think of it to be graphic for a moment. Over the last 30 to 40 years, Western working classes in North America, Western Europe and Japan, broadly defined, those working classes have been able to shift over from clothing that was relatively expensive, produced in their own societies, to clothing imported from China, which is much cheaper. The same has been true of appliances of various kinds, of construction materials, more recently of more developed goods, everything from automobiles to machinery and equipment. The bottom line is that China has become a power by exporting such items to the Western capitalists as gave them more profits. So this was a very useful partnership. Indeed, the profitability of producing in China for export helps explain why more than half of what flows out of China, mostly to North America, Western Europe, and Japan, is produced by subsidiaries of U.S., European, and Japanese corporations. So they've made money on both ends. They've been able to cheapen their labor costs by importing Chinese consumer goods, and they've cashed in on record profits producing those goods for export inside China. So when you look at all of that, you can come to the conclusion, if you have historical amnesia, that this codependency will mean that everything is hunky-dory, both sides understand the money they're making from each other. The capitalists in Western Europe, North America, and Japan wouldn't let their governments do anything militarily stupid that could undermine this profitable relationship, etc., etc., etc. And the Chinese have no interest, it would be argued, in upsetting this lovely arrangement, which is netting them the most remarkable historical experience probably in the last 1,000 years, which is the transformation in unbelievably short historical times, literally 30 years, from one of the most backward and undeveloped economic systems to the second global economic superpower, to the United States, and catching up to the United States spectacularly. For example, over the last 3 or 4 years, when the average annual growth of output in the United States was in the 1 to 2% range, whereas in China it was in the 7 to 10% range, with those kinds of differences, the narrowing of the gap is stunning. So the Chinese, it is argued, have no reason to upset the apple cart, and likewise, neither do the old capitalist centers. The problem with this analysis is, again, historical amnesia, because in the past, exactly those kinds of symbiosis existed between countries who eventually went into catastrophic wars against one another, the ultimate being World Wars I and II, which weren't that long ago. So I think the bottom line is that where there is codependence, and by the way, this is as true in interpersonal psychological relationships as it is between countries, where there is codependence, there is also immense anxiety on the part of both partners to the codependence that at some point the other partner will find someone else to dance with, someone else to carve a relationship with, some way to try to make even more money at the expense of one's codependent partner. And to ward against that, all kinds of steps are taken, which then run out of control, and the codependency turns into military war. Let me give you an example of how that's happening now. The United States is on a tear to undo, based on the Cold War legacy, which is very much with us, to undo what was the former Soviet Union. And in the quest to do that, to pry away from what was the Soviet Union, to pry away from what remains, mostly Russia, the varying other republics that together formed the USSR. And right now the focus is on a very big one, the Ukraine. That threatens Russia. Russia is now going to be looking for alternative partners to the growing cooperation with the West that had characterized Russian policy before. And the place they look first is China. And they remind China that the United States could do to you what they are doing to us here in Russia whenever they may see fit to do so. So you ought to partner with us for the same protective reasons that we are partnering with you. And over the last 24 months, a spectacular rapprochement economically between Russia and China, although the press coverage in the West of this is minimal because it runs against the rationales for what is going on. But I see that Mr. Soros is right, that the very blindness and deafness to the historical analogy, the very inability to see squarely where your policies lead, to act as if you did not have to care about how this plays out, that you're always in the immediate moment of the TV spotlight. Soros looks, for example, at the Iraq and Afghanistan adventures, which is how he understands it, as having to be understood as great publicity at the beginning, not seeing where this goes, and then getting caught up in a long losing battle, as today's headlines from both countries point out so clearly. He doesn't want the same to happen with China, because then we're in a quagmire that could extinguish us as a society, which is something that at least the smallness of Afghanistan and Iraq make unlikely.
And perhaps even as a species. Looking at some points of, potential flashpoints, certainly some points of contradiction between capitalists in the West and China, the elites in China, the domestic elites. If you look at the situation in Latin America and the Caribbean, for example, with China making huge deals with individual countries and, being present at the CELAC conference as a guest of honor, building the new canal through Nicaragua, the Transcontinental Railroad, and others, and the U.S. positing the TPP as a sort of a parry to that thrust. Do you see any of these areas of actual competition between the elites as potential flashpoints?
Absolutely. Although I would want to ground whatever it is these various elites do in the underlying pressures. The elites are followers. They love to pretend they're in command of the situation. But that is a kind of childish arrogance that really doesn't merit taking them seriously. Here's the problem for China first and then for the United States. The Chinese have embarked consciously on an unbelievable transformation in their economic situation over the last 30, 40 years. I mean, I cannot overemphasize that. They are basically moving hundreds of millions of people out of rural and agricultural pursuits that have characterized these people for many, many generations, and moving them in an unbelievably short time into the urban industrial life, particularly of the major cities and the major coastal regions of China. This is happening in a flash. They are moving these people. These people are moving themselves as life in the countryside becomes impossible. They are moving to the cities where there's barely enough housing and accommodation and infrastructure. They're racing to make that up to those people. They are betting everything on being able to accommodate this shift. And that means exporting commodities, because they've built an export-based economic system. They produce the goods that were sold and continue to be sold, above all, in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, and now secondarily elsewhere in the world. They are an exporting machine. Now, they're trying to change that. They're trying to refocus more on the domestic market, but that takes time. And they don't have time when it comes to accommodating their people. So their elites, their governing circles, their ruling groups, however you want to call it, are under an incredible pressure never to slow the economic growth of their exports alongside whatever they can do to redirect it domestically, but simply to provide jobs for the hundreds of millions that keep moving into their industrial sector. So here you are, you're stuck in this situation. They don't have much wiggle room. In order for that to work, they have to keep the currency, the price of their currency in terms of other currencies, low. They have to make it easy and cheap for people in other parts of the world to convert their currencies, the dollar, the euro, the yen, whatever, into Chinese yuan in order to purchase the exploding volume of exports coming out of China. Now fast forward to the United States. The United States has a different set of compulsions. On the one hand, it faces a desperate, vast middle sector of its working class, the people who used to have fairly secure, fairly well-paid jobs that allowed them, especially if both husband and wife worked, to live the quote-unquote American dream, or at least a rough approximation. Those people are being abandoned in the United States. Why? Because the capitalist industries are moving into China, India, and Brazil, having learned already years ago that they cannot beat the Chinese at what they're doing, becoming an export powerhouse. They made the strategic decision to join them. That is, to close their factories in North America, Western Europe, and Japan on the one hand, and move them to China, India, Brazil, and so forth on the other. Those capitalists' anxiety, which they pass on to their political representatives in Washington, is that the mass of American people being abandoned by capitalism will turn nasty, ugly, and bitter. And if you are awake, you may have noticed that, whether you look at the rhetoric of the Tea Party or you look at the behavior of our police departments, all the signs of psychological distress, material deprivation, the first new numbers showing that people enrolling in community colleges shrank over the last couple of years by 5% because they can't afford to go to the schools that might have gotten them out of the working class, et cetera, et cetera. The signs are everywhere. That's a fundamental compulsion. Meanwhile, they can't move against China because the capitalists of the United States are among the major pressures not to mess with the arrangement with China, because they've now joined that process and they are as dependent for their profits on exporting cheap stuff to the United States than are the Chinese themselves. The problem is this codependency can blow up. The Chinese have to expand their exports. The United States, on the one hand, gains from it, but domestically suffers in all kinds of ways by the pinch that comes when the Chinese are successful. They may be tempted, therefore, to try to counter-pinch. Yeah, but there we are again. We're now moving from economic warfare into a temptation to find military warfare.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.